Welcome to Subscription Heroes. I'm your host, Scott Herf. Today, we get to learn from the legendary Samuel Hulick. Samuel's a customer onboarding and activation expert who loves teaching operators how to turn their SaaS into a retention powerhouse. Samuel created SelfServeSaaS.com, a playbook and a community for optimizing scale-friendly cash flow. Here's what we cover: what the holy grail of onboarding is and how to apply it to your business, avoiding the bad habits we've learned from viral social companies, and why you should be segmenting your customers by intent. There's so much more, so let's dive in. I want to start with your latest work. What do you want people to know about self-serve SaaS?
Well, I think self-serve SaaS is really important. I mean, especially when we're talking about it within a subscription context, there are a lot of digital offerings out there that you could generally call a SaaS company or a startup or whatever tech business you want to, nomenclature you want to apply. And a lot of those business models are predicated on bringing in healthy subscription-based customers. If you are a self-serve SaaS company, then you're not only offering a digital product to people in a subscription model, but you're also hoping that they're going to convert and stay subscribed on their own. So you need to create an automated conversion process for the whole customer lifetime, since you won't have any human-driven sales functions available to help augment that. That's just a really fascinating area of where design meets business for me. I think that there is a lot of information out there about how to scale up your company in an enterprise, upmarket, sales-driven kind of way, but not a lot of information out there on how to scale your company based off of self-serve. And especially if your market is really a self-serve market, I think that there should be ways for founders to succeed without having to reinvent the wheel over and over again.
Right. It's like these principles are fairly self-evident. You know, you have lower overhead, faster scaling. Yeah, I guess Optimizely is one of the earliest examples of this back in 2014. But now it's everywhere. Problem is, you know, as you said, it's not always clear how to approach it. All right. So I guess just to establish a baseline, what are the core tenets for you of a self-serve SaaS? I'm going to keep trying to enunciate that. As a business model, not the proper noun, but the whatever the opposite of a proper noun is.
The generic, I guess. The
generic noun. Yeah.
To me, the core concept of self-serve, I think of it almost like a really sophisticated vending machine, where if you're going up to a vending machine in real life to buy a soda or a bag of pretzels or something like that, you are deciding what you want and facilitating the transaction entirely yourself. It's all one coherent entity in a way that is completely driven autonomously by the user of the vending machine, so to speak. And in a similar sense, we're creating really complicated digital vending machines and looking to create digital environments for people to be able to successfully buy their bag of pretzels or their soda. So to me, that's the gist of it, but there's plenty more complexity to dive into. I'm not sure how deep you'd like me to go.
I guess one of my questions is that if you have an existing self-serve product and you've kind of maybe stumbled your way into it, you've found some success, you know, how could you deliberately apply a self-serve SaaS model with your tenets? You know, you want to create a virtuous cycle of getting your customers more of what they want, helping them or helping your team understand your customers better. And then of course that has ongoing benefits, improved free to pay conversion and retention, et cetera. So, you know, how would you maybe, is there a framework you would apply or some tactics or anything like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a million different tactics for sure. As far as frameworks, I'm working on it. I don't think that there are a lot of really reliable ones out there right now. There are some that are kind of close. Like, I mean, there's product-led growth or jobs to be done or different conceptual frameworks to help you get into the mindset of serving users in an autonomous kind of fashion. But at the same time, I think really from a business standpoint, what you're ultimately looking to do is to turn your cost of acquiring new subscriptions into long-term, healthy lifetime subscription revenue. And as a business function, the smarter that you can get about taking your cost of acquiring a customer, your CAC, and producing LTV, lifetime value out of it, to me, that's really the name of the game, that we're trying to create processes that are smart ways for us to go out and buy quality lifetime revenue as cheap as possible. And to me, the biggest force multiplier that you can take to that approach is to create an, not to sound highfalutin, but an ecosystem in which people can succeed on their own as users when they're trying to improve their life with your offering. That's easier said than done for sure. But I think especially if you look at startups, a lot of times it's harder to break into like an enterprise sales kind of market because you've got to be SOC 2 compliant and have a million. I mean, it's a whole different ballgame. And so it's easier to get started in a self-serve kind of context where maybe you're just creating an app and selling it for $20 a month and kind of seeing what happens. But if that turns into something that has traction, the real question is, how do you then scale that out? And how do you, you know, double down on what's working or even identify what's working versus what isn't? And that's something that I see a lot of companies struggle with and then ultimately outgrow by just doing sales instead, rather than getting really, really sophisticated at the self-serve side of things and learning how to lean into those margins and squeeze as much juice out of it as they can.
That's a good segue. I saw this stat the other day on Saster, and I think it was from a presentation from Jessica Bardos from Salesforce Ventures. And she was saying that only 150 private subscription companies, I guess you could also read that as startups, have crossed $100 million. And, you know, so I haven't been a part of a lot of startups across that line. That to me seems pretty big, but I think it's a good number because, you know, only a few companies in history, there's an elite few that have unlocked this. So if you had a SaaS, you wanted to grow it to 100 million revenue starting today, where would you start? How would you unlock that growth?
So when you say 100 million revenue, is that MRR, like 100 million?
AR.
Okay. So yeah. Like closer to 10 million a month. So, I mean, if we're talking about that within a self-serve context, we also need to be thinking about just the nature of self-serve as a business model, where the business model dynamic works best in scenarios where people are wanting to make independent decisions for relatively smaller amounts of money than in a sales-driven kind of context. So in industry lingo, it's low ARPA, high volume. So low average revenue per account, but you've got a ton of accounts out there. Instead of trying to sell big contracts to Fortune 500 companies, you've got 20,000 small businesses that could be your target market, for example. And so when I'm thinking about how do I get to 100 million ARR in a self-serve context, one of the very first things that I think of is what's the amount of volume of customers that's going to make up that amount of money? And how do I find a repeatable process for not only going out and acquiring those customers, but also keeping them around as sticky, good, long-term revenue that I can be building upon month over month over month, a la, you know, having good churn, things like that. And so from that standpoint, for me, if I'm really trying to think of how do I scale out to, I don't know how to do the math in my head off the top, but, you know, out to what would at least be thousands and thousands of customers, what I would really be trying to hone in on are what are the improved life circumstances that somebody is coming to my offering for? And how do I create processes, not just around being more effective at charging them, but being more effective at getting them to the outcomes that they're hoping that my app will unlock for them in their life? And the more that we can focus on the right outcomes that are strongly correlated with really healthy long-term lifetime value, and the better that we can get in moving that lever to unlock those outcomes for people, the more likely to me it is that we would have a repeatable process for turning CAC into LTV at such a rate that we could scale it up to $100 million.
Outcomes happen outside the product, you like to say, right?
That's right. There are in-app outcomes and there are out-of-app outcomes, and every single in-app outcome is driven by an out-of-app outcome.
Let's take a little break to tell you about Churnkey, the ones making this podcast happen. Now, I think Churnkey is awesome, but I am super biased because I'm a co-founder. But I love what we're doing for subscription companies. You might look at your churn numbers and think there's got to be a way to turn this around. There's got to be someone who can improve retention and help us track down why people are leaving your product. And that's why ChurnKey's here. ChurnKey's the only platform that fixes every type of churn for you. We handle retention for customer-obsessed teams like Jasper, Fairdrop, AI Dungeon, and Castos. We lower cancellations by up to 42%, recover up to 89% of failed payments, and even increase customer LTV by 28%. And we do it with our user-friendly, customer-centric cancel flows, modern failed payment recovery, and AI-driven feedback analysis. So, if you want to run a healthier subscription business, head to churnkey.co to get started. So is there someone who comes to mind, a company that you've worked with or one that's scaling right now that makes you go, yeah, they really have got this right, or they're inspiring to me in some way, not to put you on the spot?
Yeah, no problem. I mean, MailChimp is a great example of a relatively bootstrapped self-serve business model. I did have the pleasure of working with them several years ago, and I'm quite a fan of what they accomplished there. So I'm not sure what has happened since they sold to Intuit, I think, but that's definitely a path to emulate. Although, of course, it did take quite a long time to get there for them as well, as that any company of that size would be.
Right. What was their exit again? It was 1.5 billion or something.
It's a lot. They're pretty staggering volume just in terms of daily signups, the amount of revenue they're making. It's quite a machine they have running over there.
So a while ago, we had a conversation. We were speaking about key value metrics. And just to define them, key value metrics embody the things that people do in your product that they find valuable, right? Or they extract some benefit from those things. And that makes them stay around longer. And correct me if I'm not defining this well, but I was wondering what you thought about how can businesses do a better job of uncovering or understanding or collecting their own key value metrics. The one that comes to mind is the urban legend of Facebook in the early days. The
7 friends in 3 days.
Yeah. So you got that number of friends, you're stuck around for life. So
yeah.
How can businesses do a better job of finding their own key value metrics and constantly rediscovering that as they evolve?
Sure. I love that question. Boy, there was a number of different ways we could tackle that. On the one hand, I think that a lot of the key value metric mindset out there has been largely established by go big or go home viral social companies. So Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, etc. I mean, Twitter had like follow 30 people. Facebook had 7 friends in 3 days, etc. And in all of those companies, they're not directly making money from their user base. They're making money from ads, partnerships, whatever. And so the growth metrics that they had to work with were, by definition, loosely connected to revenue at best. And therefore, you would need to use something like, well, if people follow, 30 people, then there seems to be an inflection point in terms of retention. But really, those kind of questions are more about like, how do we, especially when you start going down the road of like, how do we get like people to build habits and, get addicted to our product? A lot of the viral kind of plays don't necessarily make sense within a subscription business model where you are saying, hey, we're here to help provide value to you. And we want this to be a good deal for you, where ideally you're happy to pay $20 a month, $200 a month, whatever that is, in exchange for all the benefits that our offering unlocks for you. And so to me, the question really becomes less focused on key value metrics in terms of engagement and user behavior in the abstract, and more about what are the specific goals that are driving people to find your offering to be relevant to begin with, and how do you speak to those goals as much as possible and identify which of those goals most closely correlate with revenue, which is something that like a Twitter or a LinkedIn wouldn't necessarily be able to do. And so I feel like I'm kind of losing the thread here. I apologize, but
I think it's telling that the most prominent, prevalent examples of these mythical key value metrics, and they do sort of have the air of urban legend, right?
Absolutely.
But they're all tied to social apps and growth-minded virality. SaaS key value metrics aren't, I don't know, I guess they're not as cinematic or fun to discuss in certain cases, I guess in pop culture, right?
Yeah, I mean, urban legends are only worth so much. And I think that when companies who do have a closer connection to revenue, who are charging their customer base directly, try to emulate the Twitter and Facebook type growth approaches, a lot of times I'll see maybe a data scientist will come up with something where it's like, there's an inflection point in retention if somebody creates 3 projects. So let's gear our activation experience around getting people to over that 3 project threshold, where you know for a fact that nobody is like, you know what's great about this thing is like I can make 3 projects with it. Nobody's coming to you for that. That's a byproduct of them trying to do something else that's actually meaningful to them. And the more that you can put your finger on the pulse of what's actually meaningful to people, and again, confirm that that is something that correlates strongly with long-term healthy revenue production, then you have the makings of at least a hypothesis that you can be trying to build out a process around optimizing. Whereas if you're trying to optimize for creating 3 projects, yeah, in theory, you could be like gamifying it so that more people go in and create 3 instances of whatever project is in your app. But that doesn't mean that they're getting value. And it probably doesn't really mean that getting more those extra people to do that arbitrary thing is going to unlock more value in the form of revenue for you either. It's not the thing that's causing people to pay you. Where to me, that's really the name of the game is identifying what's the driving force that leads people to want to give you money in an ongoing kind of way. And how do you just keep doubling down on that as much as possible instead?
I've been in conversations in rooms where I've had similar conversations where, you know, it's the 3 project fallacy, I guess we'll call it. It just cracks me up because it's just so simplistic. And I guess it's a reflection of maybe someone doesn't know where to start, or they're just exhausted by all the inputs. And this is the most common or, I don't know, prevalent metric that popped up in all of the mixed panel dashboards or whatnot. Are there any common places to start in uncovering these key value metrics, or just common ones you see across the board in SaaS?
One big recommendation that I make is to segment by intent. So if somebody is, for example, creating their account, and you can ask them, what are the benefits that you're here to unlock? How can we be of help to you? You know, you would phrase it in a more familiar kind of way, but asking them basically like, what are you here for help with? And letting people identify, this thing, not that thing, but this thing. And when they press a button that answers the survey question that says, this is what I'm here for, then you can flag that particular user for tracking. You can see how likely it is that people who say they're here for option A actually go on to convert or are retained in month 2 or month 3 versus people who say they're here for option B or who say, I'm not here for any of these options. In which case you have a mismatch between your messaging and your product's value proposition. One general recommendation that I would make is that there's a lot of opportunity, in my opinion, in the chasm between what marketing is focused on, which is usually driving top of funnel signups, trial starts, very high level account creation kind of things. And ultimately, what product is focused on, which is delivering capabilities for long-term healthy customers. How those marketing signups turn into products, long-term customers, is an area that I think a lot of companies have as an oversight, even just organizationally. They've got their marketing department, they've got their product department, maybe they've got customer success, maybe they've got growth, but really, like, who's really watching to see, are these new trials that we're getting high quality? Are they likely to convert? Do we have a general theory in place around what inflection points people need to experience in order for them to convert, et cetera? I think that there's just a lot happening there that is really interesting to explore, but maybe because of general org chart design tends to be overlooked in most companies.
Oh yeah, I've definitely seen that happen before. You know, it's like, hey, marketing goes, hey, we've got you all the leads you asked for. And product goes, yeah, but they're all churning. And finance goes, you got to do something about, you know, this churn problem. And it's just passing the baton around, and who ultimately owns that, right? Who has the ability to cut through and solve the problem of the mismatch?
Yep, 100%.
That's another podcast, I'm sure.
Yeah,
absolutely. Or a whole management course, right? So, you know, you mentioned onboarding and segmentation, and you said in the past that the holy grail of customer onboarding and ultimately customer success is context aware or segmented onboarding. And I actually saw this the other day in PseudoWrite. It's an AI assisted fiction writing app started by my two friends, Amit Gupta and James Yu, for full disclosure. So it's amazing. You come into the app and it asks you, what type of story are you working on? And you type in freeform, I'm writing a novel about a space opera or a heist fantasy. I don't know why that came to mind, but sure, we'll go with it. You know, then it literally shows you with that context and that hyper awareness. It says, hey, so maybe in a space opera, you need to come up with some characters like Luke and Star Wars. And it makes these crazy references too. I just thought it was pretty incredible. So I'll send you some screenshots after. But I guess my question is, what are the key elements of this context-aware onboarding experience? You mentioned a few before, but I imagine it starts with someone's role and or mix of what key benefit am I looking to get out of your product?
Yeah, I think it's really a question of just meeting people where they're currently at. One really simple example that I remember hearing about was there was a company that it was a mobile app that gave guitar lessons, and they tried all kinds of different things to improve their activation and conversion rates. And a lot of them didn't work, as is the case with any kind of growth experiments. But one that they finally landed on that did work was just a simple question when you're just going through the onboarding, which is, what's your current skill in playing guitar? Are you absolute beginner? Are you, you know, do you know how to read sheet music? So on and so forth. And just by getting an understanding of where people were at, they were able to tailor the lessons to somebody who had the level of skill that the person claimed to have. And doing that alone made it a lot easier for the software company to identify what would be relevant and what wouldn't be relevant to any given person, depending on the situation that they had self-reported as being in. And that is really freeing from a software design perspective, because you don't have to just kind of satisfice and create a one-size-fits-all experience that in theory could be useful to anybody, but in practice is not actually made for anybody. Where really, if you can get some contextual clues about somebody, and ideally those clues would be not only about their current situation, like how good are you currently at playing guitar, but like, why do you want to become better at guitar? Like, what are the things that you want to be able to learn? If you can get an understanding of where somebody's currently at and where they're trying to get to, especially as it relates to how they're trying to leverage your app to get there, then it's a lot easier. It's almost just like paint by numbers of like, oh, okay, well, you need to do this and this and this. You can lay out a whole journey for them. Not like you railroad them through it like a wizard. You still can provide the optionality, but you can choose what to surface as far as what's relevant to them at any given time. And so from that standpoint, I think segmentation is extremely powerful and under-leveraged, especially within the realm of product design. Even something really simple, like if you were asking people, let's say an invoice sending app, if you were asking people why they wanted to send invoices, and one category of people said that they wanted to appear bigger so that they could land a big new client, and they wanted to step up their invoicing game because of that. And then another category of people said that the person who handled their invoices left the company and they just have a zip drive with Word documents in it and they don't know what to do. That's a whole different category of concern and problems to be solved. And even if you just like took that segmentation information and just had a different testimonial on the billing page, that spoke specifically to, man, it was amazing how blah, blah, blah helped me get all my Word docs imported into a thing. And now I don't have to worry about lapsed payments anymore. If that's the testimonial that they see after they told you that that's their problem that they're having, it's much more likely that they'll go, oh, okay. Kind of like as a kid, when you play hotter and colder, where it's like getting warmer, you want to let people know that they're getting warmer as much as possible. And that's not, you're getting closer to 7 friends in 3 days, or you're getting closer to 3 projects. It's you're getting closer to the stuff that you care about.
I love how you put that, because it creates this insane feedback cycle of, okay, these people, we've successfully identified this type of customer that we can call them out, and then we're seeing the progress through. But also, we're getting other product ideas too, where if you want to appear bigger to land a client and that segment takes off, then you can do all sorts of product enhancements to satisfy that and you know, increase retention and all that good stuff. And then it informs marketing too, to your point.
Yeah, I was just going to say the same thing. Yeah, it can inform your acquisition strategy. It can inform what your ad copy is, who you're running your ads to. You know, I mean, it's really thinking about it. That's why I was using the highfalutin term of ecosystem earlier, where like one example that comes to mind, this isn't really segment specific, but I just recently started getting the activation emails from Buzzsprout, which is a podcast hosting service. And one of the first lifecycle emails that they sent was, here's our guide on the best microphones under $100. And that's not an email that's like, you haven't made 3 projects yet, log in to get 3 projects started, or anything that's like tone deaf or just speaking only to like the practical logistics that need to take place in order for somebody to like make the app function. But instead, they're understanding, like, if they just come in and say, upload your podcast episode as the very first step, it assumes that people have a podcast episode or a podcast at all, or even a microphone, or know where to start, or any of those kind of art, you know, podcast titles, and all of those kind of things are hard to figure out. And so if you really want to take on the customer's problems and genuinely help guide them to places that they couldn't get to without you, sometimes it involves helping them understand the best microphones under $100, but that's not, has nothing to do with the operation of your interface.
And I love how it's, yeah, removing a constraint that they have no control over. It's a physical thing. And I faced this in a different startup where you had to buy physical personal key. I remember hardware keys. It's been not that long, but I already forget the terminology. But like a Trezor or a Ledger. And you had to wait for that thing to come in. And then you had to go back to the app and set it up. So there's this period where people forget about you. But if you can identify that segment, knock down the barriers, get them to a solution faster. Outcome happening outside the product. You've got your gear now. Now I'm set up. Now I'm sure there's another activate lifecycle email where it's like how to tune your mic or how to connect it with this or whatever, right?
Yep, 100%. It's basically your problems are my problems and we're going to try to solve them as comprehensively as possible. Because I mean, even if you think about it, like in the case of Buzzsprout, like their total addressable market changes depending on what their approach is. If they're only going to help people who already have a podcast episode recorded, that's a way smaller market than people who are wanting to start a podcast but don't really know where to begin. And if you can come in early and be helpful when they're in the figuring it out phase, it's going to really build the kind of trust that would lead to a really healthy long-term subscription further down the line. So it's a question also of just of timing and market specificity, where you could say, well, we really want to help people who already have podcast art and have already recorded 5 episodes and they're just looking to find a better host for their services. But your market is way smaller by consequence of that. Your market is basically just your competitors' customers rather than a very wide pool of people who are somewhere in the journey of trying to start their podcast instead.
Yeah, I mean, and it's especially relevant too, because I think podcasting as an industry declined something like 5% last year. So continuing to get new blood in is even more important and more of a challenge.
I think that's relevant for any business. Like you, especially when we talk self-serve, you really got to be thinking volume and ideally also expansion, as you would with any kind of SaaS business. But you don't have the giant whales coming in and spending the equivalent of all of the rest of your customers just in one account or something like that to be able to save you, so to speak. You really have to be, whether you like it or not, you have to be in much closer touch with the heartbeat of your growth process.
I want to ask about segmentation. One thing I've seen in companies where you work really hard on onboarding, it's a huge priority. You nail down whatever you call it, the persona, the customer profile, whatever you want to call it. And you have these segmentation questions and role questions, and then you kind of move on. It becomes stale over time, not because you're neglecting it on purpose, but because you're busy, you're putting out fires everywhere. And then the data you look at just kind of starts to tilt and shift in a way that it starts making less sense. You know, how do you go and make sure that this is, do you put a team on this, you know, to revisit this every quarter? I don't know. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask an AI question too. Could AI do this? Probably, who knows? But how do you keep this these segments, you know, fresh and prevent them from going stale?
Well, yeah, I think that you want to keep your finger on the pulse of how things are trending at any given moment. And this is this again speaks back to maybe the org chart disconnect that we were talking about before, where marketing's focused on their metrics, products focused on their metrics, and that hopefully all of these things just kind of come together to produce good unit economics. Whereas for me, I like to start by looking at the unit economics and get an understanding of like, what is our CAC to LTV ratio right now? How long does it take to pay off our cost of customer acquisition? Is it 10 months? Is it 14 months? What does that do to our cash flow? So on and so forth. And to me, if you start with revenue and then reverse engineer different points of leverage along the customer journey that could impact revenue, I think that that's more compelling than, well, we sifted through the data and found that you got to create 3 projects and then you're more likely to still be logging in 2 months later. So let's try to make that happen. I can understand why companies would want to move on from that or generally speaking, not find a lot of success in doing that repeatedly. But at the same time, I really would advocate for not thinking of your activation process as a feature that you just ship and then revisit every couple of years. To me, it's really the heartbeat of your company. This is how you're going out and you're actively investing money to bring in new subscribers. And you continually want to be informed as to whether the new subscribers that you're bringing in are at least on track to be as healthy as your past subscribers, if not more. And ideally that you're acquiring them at a more scale-friendly acquisition cost, so on and so forth. And so to me, that's something that those are trends that are taking place within your data and within your customer base on a daily basis. And to just revisit that every couple of years, to me, is a concerning way of approaching it, in my opinion.
Amen to that. Yeah, it ends up being one of those, in the places I've been, you know, one of those all hands on deck, 3-month grind fests, and then you put it on the shelf and it's like, why did we do this? Just to get a bump in metrics or survey results or something for a few months. And then, you know, it's frustrating. I want to close with 2 questions. The first is, if you're reading a book or have read a long form piece lately, which one particularly had an effect on you?
There's a book that I came across that is, I think it's out of print, so it's a little hard to recommend it. It was really...
I already love it.
Yeah, exactly. But it's called Reframing Business by, let's see, I've got it on my desk here, Richard Norman. Norman, Normann. And this was a book that I heard recommended in a lecture on an economics theory called Service Dominant Logic, which is similar to a lot of the concepts that we've been talking about today. And they built out this theory largely inspired by the work of Richard Norman, who wrote the book Reframing Business. So I was like, all right, I should check this out. And I like never underline or like dog ear pages. Like I always just leave my books pristine. And this one like almost literally has a highlighter on every single page where I'm just like, oh man, this is, the way they're putting this is like completely, the, you know, the in line with how I see it too. And I found that very, very inspiring. So that's the book that I'm working my way through right now. And strongly recommend it if you're willing to take the chance on a, on an expensive, obscure out of print book.
The best kinds. Well, maybe not the expensive part, but
right.
just for our listeners, for one last, you know, high octane tip, what would you leave them with? Could be about design, leadership, reading, up to you.
I think really for me, one of the keys that I see missing in our industry is a real sense of investment and actually following through on the expectations that you're setting with your customer base. A lot of people will create value propositions that sound good on the surface, but are maybe kind of abstract. Or even like a company that, you know, let's say that they're really well-intentioned and they go out and they do switch interviews to identify the different jobs to be done, you know, considerations that their business might be serving, and, you know, thinking about how that could inform their marketing or the way that they position their offering or things like that. And I think that's great, but I would also recommend that we really think about how do we create systems that reliably follow through on the promises that we're making. And if we're identifying jobs to be done, instead of just using those to put a different spin on our marketing and our positioning, how do we create systems that actually get people to the places that they're hoping the jobs will get them to arrive at, and build out the processes that reliably help make people make incremental progress toward becoming better at playing guitar or appearing better to bigger to potential clients with their invoices or whatever it is that they're trying to unlock in their life? How do we take on those problems and create systems that genuinely are geared toward increasing the likelihood that people are successful with those out of app outcomes, rather than just making sort of hand wavy promises and giving everybody a one size fits all interface?
Could not agree more. The promise needs to be more, not just a guidepost, but, you know, actually follow through and to be taken as a commitment. So I love that you said that. I'm grateful for you coming on. Thank you so much.
A pleasure, of course.
Awesome. Thanks. Don't miss out on future episodes. Get alerts for new drops at subscriptionheroes.co or follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Special thanks to Churnkey for sponsoring the show. Learn how to make customers happier while boosting revenue at churnkey.co. Your support for this show has been incredible so far, and let's keep the momentum going. We are all slaves to the algorithm. Ratings and reviews really do help. Please rate us 5 stars on your platform of choice. We'll be truly grateful. That's all for now. I'm Scott Hirsch, and this has been Subscription Heroes.